Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Just a moment here, we will be talking with David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois. And for a long time now, he's been stopping by once a month on Friday to talk about personal finance and money management. The idea of the program here is that if you have a question about your own financial situation, whatever it is you're thinking about, this is one place you can get some advice. Put that into your total mix of things that you're thinking about as you're making your financial decisions. And we'll get underway in just a moment. Before, though, we do that, I want to remind you of another financial concern, and that's our budget here at WILL. We rely on listeners for the single largest portion of our financial support. So that makes it imperative that as many people as possible, everyone would be great, but as many people as possible who listen to WILO, we need you to financially support the station. We hope that you will give us a call. Call our pledge number, which is 244-9455, and make a contribution. You can go online also at willpledge.org and make a contribution that way. It's very important here to continue to keep the programming here strong. We need your financial support. The resources are very important to keep paying for those programs from National Public Radio and everything that we do here locally. Now, as an incentive, Mr. Sinnoh, he comes into the studio this morning and he says, "Did you know that I've been coming here doing this program now for 16 years?" And I said, "Wow, 16 years, pretty cool." He says, "What he will do to encourage people to make a contribution is for anyone who calls in this morning and makes a pledge of $40 or more, he will add $16. So that's $1 for every year that he's been doing Focus 580. And he quickly pulled out his calculator and said, that's a 40% boost in the value of your contribution. So that's the deal. That's one way he's been good enough to encourage people to call. So 244-9455. That is the number to call. Make a contribution of $40 or more, and David Sinnoh will add $16 to however much you contribute. And that will get us even that much closer to making our goal. And it's really important that we hear from as many people as possible, because this fall we have shortened our fund drive. We want to get to giving you the programming. So we've made it shorter, but that only works if it only works when people call and make their contributions. So with that, we will say good morning and welcome to the program.
Glad to have you here. Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. As you mentioned, this fall marks the 16th year I've been privileged to be part of WILL programming. David, I'm getting younger. I can't say the same for you, but clearly I'm getting younger. And as you know, I deeply believe in the mission of WILL, its programming, and I continue, frankly, to marvel. I really do at the dedication of the wonderful staff of WILL that really makes all of this possible. So that's why I wanted to issue that challenge. Please call in, pledge at least a minimum of $40, and I'll be happy to match $16 to that pledge during this particular hour. Well, let's talk briefly about the stock market. That seems to be hot news for everyone. And first, I'd like to recap the last quarter, the third quarter of this year, and then we'll take a look at the first 3 weeks of October. Now, historically, third quarters in the stock market, interestingly enough, have been the worst performing quarters. But for 2006, for example, the S&P 500 hit a 5.5-year high. The NASDAQ is less than 4% from 5-year highs. And we've all been following the Dow Jones Industrial Average, literally making its way into brand new territory almost each day. The third quarter, of course, saw the Federal Reserve twice keep interest rates on hold. Even as the housing market slowed and the cost of oil, the cost of natural gas, realized a significant decline, it wasn't very long ago that gasoline was more than $3 a gallon. It's around $2.15, $2.20. I saw it as low as $1.99 about 3 weeks ago in Indiana. Many on Wall Street are optimistic that the U.S. economy actually is headed for this so-called soft landing. In the third quarter, the Dow Jones Industrial Average actually advanced 4.7% during the quarter. The S&P rose 5.2%, and as I mentioned, approaching brand new highs. And even the NASDAQ composite gained 4% in the quarter, making it really its best third quarter performance since 2003. Some of the commodities didn't fare so well. That's maybe a good thing. It means inflation perhaps is slowing down. Gold, platinum, palladium, and obviously a broad decline in the energy sector, marked really interestingly enough by heating oil and natural gas, which logged about 30% declines for the third quarter in value. So that's pretty interesting news. I think that's good news for the consumer, especially in light of the fact that we see very, very strong corporate profits in the major corporations of this country, which is also giving credence to this stock market rally. Well, October, stocks still plunging ahead, continue to surge, with yesterday the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing above 12,000. Now, if anybody can remember back to 1980 and 1981, guess where the Dow was? 750. And the conversation was, well, was the Dow ever going to hit 1,000? And today it's 12,000. This index has actually increased 16 times in value, despite a brutal stock market in 1987, a very, very tough time in the years 2000 to 2002. Now, unlike the S&P 500 index, the Dow Jones is a price-weighted index. So the largest components of the Dow are made up of companies that have high prices. Some of those companies are IBM, Boeing, Altria, that's the fancy name for Philip Morris and the cigarette magnates, 3M, and Exxon. A lot of those stocks are trading in the mid-80s or the high 80s. So the Dow actually for the year has surged ahead some 14.1% through yesterday's close. And you could buy what's called an exchange-traded fund, a tracking stock. It's called the DIA, and you could actually own the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Well, what if we compare my good old-fashioned couch potato portfolio with the Dow, at least through yesterday's close? First, the couch potato portfolio, which obviously you can access on WILL. You can look at the 8 indexed mutual funds from Vanguard, which comprise my couch potato portfolio. Suffice it to say that 70% are U.S. indexes, 30% are international indexes. And really, here's the bottom line. Through yesterday's close, the couch potato portfolio is up at least 14.8%. Slightly ahead of the Dow for the year. And I've had a number of people call me, email me, and say, is that 14.8% or whatever percent you were quoting last month, does that include the fees on the mutual funds? And the answer is clearly yes. That is the net of all fees, but it also includes the dividends in those particular indexes. So dividends for the year on the S&P are about 1.5%. So you can figure the dividends have added about 1 to 1.5% to that overall return of 14.8. Bottom line, that makes me happy. I'm a happy person. To be honest about it, my wife is happy with a 14.8% return. And for those of you in the couch potato portfolio, I presume you are happy as well. Now, I'd like to switch for just a moment. Let's talk interest rates very, very briefly. Yesterday, late in the day, I visited with Frank Balin, who is the owner of Revere Mortgage in Champaign-Urbana, and I wanted to confirm something that I felt was happening in the mortgage markets and in the interest rate markets as well. And that is that mortgage rates and interest rates really have been trending lower. For example, if you are interested in a 15-year amortizing mortgage, that rate is now below 6%. It's back in the high fives. We've seen rates between 5.75% and 5.875%, and that's a significant drop from just a month ago. 20-year rates are about 6 to 6.125%. 30-year rates are about 6.25%. And 5-year, what are called ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages, where you lock in the rate for 5 years, and then the rate can move 2% up or down in any direction, with a maximum of 6% additional during the life of the loan. Well, that first 5 years, if you will, is locked in at 6%. So we're seeing these rates pretty darn competitive. And in spite of a very slow housing market in many, many parts of the country, people who are moving into housing and being able to bid much lower prices, they're also getting the benefit of pretty decent mortgage rates. Now, when we compare mortgage rates today to the 10-year Treasury note, the 10-year Treasury is at about 4.75%. So if you put your money in a 10-year Treasury and held it, at least today, the yield would earn you about 4.75%. So the difference in interest rates between a 30-year mortgage rate of 6 1/8 and a 10-year Treasury rate of 4.75 is about 1.5%. So that difference is 1.5%. Historically, that difference is closer to 1.75 to 2%, so that range has narrowed. It's constricted. So here's the bottom line, at least in my opinion, and I usually don't go out on the fence very often about interest rates because, unfortunately, David, you and WIL have not provided me with a crystal ball. I'm still waiting for a crystal ball. I get that tornado ball or whatever from Ed, you know, that's very nice. But it's not really a crystal ball that tells me the direction of interest rates. But I feel pretty strongly about this. Either mortgage rates are too cheap or Treasury rates are going to fall further because that 1.5% needs to increase. That range needs to increase. So interest rates are either going to go down lower or mortgage rates are going to trend back up just a bit. As far as which one, I have no idea. Again, I'm waiting for that WILL crystal ball. Perhaps some of that money on this $16 challenge, which I've issued this hour, we could go out and procure and purchase that crystal ball. I'm not absolutely sure about that. So there you have it, David, and I'd be delighted to address these kinds of issues, the stock market, interest rates, or any other wealth management issues on the minds of our listeners.
All right. We got one of those magic eight balls. We could ask it.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that the quality of advice we'd get would be very good.
All right.
All right. We have a caller here to talk with, someone in Loda. We'll start with them. Line one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have several questions and about interest rates. For 20 years, I have been investing in bonds, but I'm a very unsophisticated investor because I don't understand in the opposite end. When I loan the money to the companies, utilities and municipals,
yes,
I concentrate on the interest, how much I was going to be gaining. And everybody knows they pay very low compared to other investment vehicles. But I was okay until I began to save quite a bit. And so my expenses went up because I thought psychologically, well, I can pay a little bit more. So then this year I decided I want to try real estate. So I went and I bought an old building. And I'm remodeling it. So I think you told a caller last month that an investor should focus on when they're going to borrow, how much they're going to pay as opposed to how much they're gaining on their investments. And so with my bonds, I was getting 4.5, 4.75. And if I went and borrow, it was at 8 for the remodeling project. So I decided to take to finance it myself. But you know what happened? The fees ended up about $7,000 because I didn't hold to maturity. You know, you don't lose your principal if you hold your bonds to maturity. But I cashed.
You cashed them in early, and they had gone down in value.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now the question is, I'm halfway, so I did half of the project, but now I need more to continue with the second phase. I still have what I need to finish it, but I don't want to pay again the same fees. But I don't understand how
this happens.
Well, no, how to judge who has the best interest rate? Is it the banks? Is it the credit cards? Or those brokers that offer you mortgage loans for the property.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I can use the same property to borrow against it, but they're only brokers. They're not bankers.
Well, the difference between a broker and a banker is that the broker is using someone else's money. The rates may be identical. So you can't decide on whether it's a broker or a banker.
Well,
you really have to look
at
the closing costs and the rates.
The question is, can you give me the formula?
Well, there's not a magic formula, but let me address this sort of in the gestalt. Let me start at the beginning.
But I was going to ask you, how do the credit cards charge interest?
Well, the credit that's very complicated. You don't want to get involved with credit cards.
Well, I don't.
The minute you don't, the minute you don't pay a credit card at the end of the month on time, you can bet that that interest rate is going to be somewhere between 14% and 24%. Okay, so that's not a good idea.
I want to understand it when they say, like, I have zero because my credit is very good. So I have zero for 1 year, but now I need more than 1 year. So how do they, for example, right now they're giving me 1.99, but then my bank gives me 8. But then I look at the statement in the credit card. So I want to know, how do they figure the monthly interest so that I can judge who at the end is like, I feel like they're very deceiving. And the 1.99 may not be 1.99 or may not be. That's all I need. And I call the credit cards and I ask them, how do you figure? I can figure out when the bond company is going to pay me my interest. I multiply the principal by the interest rate.
Yes.
But then it seems like they use a different formula and nobody knows it.
Well, every credit card company has different formulas. That's number one, and they charge different rates. And the real issue with a credit card company is, are you paying on time? So the rate which they provide you with, which is called a teaser rate, whether it's a 6-month rate, a 9-month rate, a 12-month rate, is good so long as your payment arrives on time. And that 1.99 or that 0.99 is usually based upon a 360-day calendar year. All right? It's a short-term rate. It's called a money rate. And it's based upon a 360-day calendar year, not a 365-day calendar year. That's number one. Number two, the minute you are late, the minute your payment does not arrive on time, then the fine print will tell you that all bets are off, and that rate will immediately arise to an annualized rate of somewhere, typically I've seen them anywhere from 14 to 24%. All right? So if you are on a 24% annualized rate, that rate is a 360-day rate, not a 365-day rate. So the effective rate is even higher. So that's a problem. But in terms of actually saying, what is this credit card company doing versus that credit card company, I can't answer that because each card company has different rates, different terms, and they're changing all of the time. Keep in mind it's based upon a 360-day period. Keep in mind that if you are ever late on any credit card payment, other credit card companies can immediately raise your rate. Because in the fine print, it says if you've got a Visa and you've got a MasterCard and you're late on your MasterCard, the Visa card can actually raise your rate. So that's a problem. Here's the bottom line. The bottom line is that I would not be doing any kind of long-term financing with credit cards. That is a gigantic error and mistake.
Okay.
That's number one. Number two, as you have learned, do you own individual bonds or are you in a bond fund?
Individual.
Okay, that's the good news. The good news is that if you're in individual bonds, then probably the bonds that have least depreciated are the shortest term bonds, the bonds that you're getting your money back fastest on, which is called duration. So the bonds that have the least duration probably will fall the least in value, and those would be the bonds that you would sell first. I have no problem with you self-financing this program as opposed to paying 7, 8, 9% at a bank or a mortgage, because this is an income property. This is an income property, and those rates could be anywhere from 7 to 9%. So I really don't think that's a problem unless you're taking a severe bath or a severe loss on cashing in a bond. But as you've learned, if you don't hold a bond to maturity, you have interest rate risk, which means that the value of the bond can go down if interest rates move up, which has been happening for some time until very recently. You have purchasing power risk when the bond eventually matures and you get your money back from the corporation. You're getting back cheaper dollars. They don't pay as much. You can't buy as much. And finally, with any bond other than a treasury, you have something called default risk. So I presume that you're buying very, very high-quality financial instruments.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Triple A, double A.
Okay, good.
Single.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
Okay, the next question. Okay, I will forget the credit card issue. Now, I have a rental property in Florida, and I can, if I don't want to use the bonds to finance this, then I can just use that. So my best option is either continue self-financing or borrow against the building or the property.
Yeah, and don't forget that if you have substantial equity in the building, that you might be able to negotiate a very favorable rate. Most of the rates that are quoted are based upon the fact that you are borrowing 70 to 75% of the fair market value of the building. If you have already self-financed a very substantial portion where your equity is...
Yes, and I already have a rent.
And you have rent, and where you have equity of 50% or more, you may be in the driver's seat and you can negotiate a lower interest rate. So go back and see what kind of interest rate you can negotiate based upon the fact that you have so much equity in the property.
We have several callers here, and they would like to talk with Dave, and so we will do that with our next caller in Homewood, line 4.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, yeah.
Hi, good morning.
I enjoy your show every time. And in regard to your earlier prophecy of mortgage rates going up, interest down, would part of the answer be in our current national debt?
Tell me your thinking.
We owe a lot of money, this country does.
Yes.
And sooner or later, somebody's going to ask, why are we owing so much? And they're going to start demanding more interest.
No question about that. No question about that. So that certainly could spur interest rates moving higher. And that certainly is one scenario. And that would mean that mortgage rates would move back up as well. It's very interesting when you talk and read about the commentators. It's sort of 50-50. And interestingly enough, one of the great bond and interest rate gurus in this country, Bill Gross, who runs the Pinnacle Funds and a number of other very, very impressive bond funds, and just one of the great prognosticators and really has outperformed most of the bond indexes for a number of years, he is predicting lower interest rates. I find that interesting.
Near term.
Going into next year.
Yeah.
That we're going to see actually lower interest rates. You're ultimately right. People are going to have to bid up to continue to fund our debt, fund this enormous engine of debt. People are going to demand more interest because otherwise the value of their dollars are not worth as much when they get them paid back.
Right.
So they've got to get some return. So I agree with you.
So the question really is just when.
When, absolutely.
Okay, so I'll let you work on that.
All right, well, thanks. I'll let David work on it, too.
Thanks for the call. We'll go back to the Magic 8-Ball there and ask it. Line 1 is Champagne. Next caller. Hello.
Yeah, again, you make a real contribution. Appreciate it a great deal.
And thanks.
You should say that it felt like 8 years, you know.
Maybe 4 would be better.
4
you know?
Would be...
You know, whatever.
Well, what you could have done is made it... equivalent to the interest rate.
You know, there you go.
Or something. Just some general things. Sort of maybe a criticism of the industry. I always like it when the market drops and they say it's profit taking, which I don't quite look at that as profit taking. Not it's at somebody else's cost, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I mean, I like that spin.
Mm-hmm.
I heard some percentages and just. I find it sort of fascinating. In the financial market, is that 15% of our gross national product or not?
The financials in the financial market?
Well,
in other words, what percentage of the goods and services of our GDP are
right.
financial?
Right. Is that way off? Or
Probably not. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. What,
medical, for example, is pushing 16% of GDP.
Okay. Because it was mentioned, I'm really concerned about the manufacturing sector, that it was mentioned that it's down to 12%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess this concept that I heard a while back in terms of economics and all that, value added, and that certainly with manufacturing, I would assume you get a greater value added than in the service industry.
Than pushing paper?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that is a huge concern, that while we continue to create jobs on a monthly basis, although that has slowed down, we see again over the last few months that the manufacturing sector is suffering and lesser jobs. Part of that, of course, is look at our automobile industry, our steel industry, et cetera. Very, very tough industries, just on very hard times.
But, you know, it seems to me that if we got serious about energy and manufacturing and research and development in that area, that could be a whole new growth industry for this country.
Mm-hmm. And I think you'd probably have to convince the politicians
right.
how to go about that.
And the final one I found interesting is that the demands in the newspaper industry, the 25%, is that they talk about profit or is that a margin? In other words, the expectation of Wall Street, you know, with the newspaper industry, that these high returns. I mean, I don't know too many industries that get that kind of return.
Yeah, I'm surprised at that number. I would guess that that's a margin number and not a profit because, frankly, most newspapers, at least the newspaper sector, is under enormous pressure because of the drop of advertising, direct advertising in those newspapers. So I'm guessing that 25%, although I can't say for certain, is a margin issue and not a profit. I haven't seen any newspapers that are generating a 25% profit to the bottom line.
Yeah, no, it might be more of a gross margin. Well, again, you've done a tremendous contribution to the program.
Well, thanks for your insightful comments, and I appreciate that accolade. Thanks very much.
Let's go on. We'll talk with someone. This is also someone in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I have a stack of double E bond, $100 bonds, dating back several years. Is there any point of keeping them only a certain length of time? If you keep them longer, will they make more interest?
Well, no. There is a period of time where your double E's actually stop generating interest.
Oh.
So you need to take those into the bank to find out whether or not they are still generating interest and at what interest rate.
Uh-huh.
Because some of those double E's are paying very good interest rates, higher than market rates. So what I would do is I would take my stack. I'm proud of you for having a stack of these bonds. That's very, very nice. And any financial institution has the materials right there, either on computer or in hard copy, that can tell you when the bonds mature, at what interest rates they mature, when they stop generating interest. Now, you do have an opportunity with these old double E's that, remember, if you cash them in, the difference between what you paid and what you get is interest.
Right.
And you would have to report that on your income tax.
Yes, they give you a slip, don't they?
Absolutely. And if you do that, the government will give you a big kiss and thank you for paying your fair share of tax. But alternatively, you can take the double E's, a certain percentage of them, and place them in H bonds.
H.
And that will defer your paying tax on the interest. So let's say that you have a $25 bond and it's now worth $75. So that's $50 of interest. If you cash it in, you'd have to pay $50 of – you'd have to report $50 of interest income and pay tax on that.
Uh-huh.
Alternatively, you could take your $75 value in the double E bond and buy an H bond.
Okay.
And then that $75 is now generating interest income twice a year.
Uh-huh.
Those pay twice a year. And that is an alternative, so you need to look at that as a possibility – with your double E bonds.
Okay, I have another, only maybe you know. If I would do that into an H, like hooray bonds.
Yep, hooray bonds. There we are.
Can I designate that to my son then? Because I'm quite senior.
Well, you sound like you're in pretty good shape, but certainly you could add another individual
mm-hmm.
to your designation. And you, I believe you could also put his Social Security number
uh-huh.
on those bonds. What you would effectively be doing, though, if you did that, is you'd be making a gift of the fair market value of those bonds to your son.
Uh-huh.
And we know that under the annual exclusionary laws, the gift tax rules, you can gift individually, without any tax, $12,000 of fair market value each year to as many people as you want. In addition to that, there is a $1 million additional exclusion. So here's the bottom line, although you could check with your tax accountant if you have one. Uh-huh. Probably you could gift, if you will, if you're going to change the Social Security numbers into H bonds or add your son on those H bonds. Uh-huh. Then my guess is you could do that entirely gift tax free.
All right.
If the bonds remain in your Social Security number and you add your son, when you get interest, if you are collecting the interest, uh-huh. that interest, of course, will be taxable to you.
Uh-huh.
All right?
Right.
Okay, so check at the bank, check with your tax advisor, and if you really like my answer a whole lot, you could add one of my daughters, on that stack of bonds. That's
right.
Okay, too.
I'd be happy to add you also.
All right. Well, the more the merrier.
Thank you. Probably. Right.
Thanks so much.
Very generous. Let's go here to line 3. This is also Champagne. Hello. So call there in line 3 in Champagne.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Quick question. My wife and I are thinking of getting some more I-bonds. As you know, I'm sure, the rates change November 1.
Yes.
And I seem to remember last May, one of the syndicated financial columnists was saluting the fact that the base rate or the fixed rate had gone up to 1.4, and he said the composite rate isn't too attractive, 2.41, I believe, because the interest is so small. But wait until, if you get them now, when the interest rates go up toward the end of the year, and I'm sure they are, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I know you have no crystal ball, but someone with all your experience and expertise probably has a good sense of which way the wind's blowing. And I was trying to connect what you said at the beginning of the program to our situation. But what do you think about I-bonds before the 1st of November?
I'm concerned. I'll be honest with you. I'm concerned. I think there's some interest rate risk. And I don't have a crystal ball, and I really don't know. But I would be – whatever you purchase should be a small percentage of your overall portfolio. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
I just wouldn't go in there whole hog, so to speak, and at any one point in time put a tremendous amount of money in. I think regardless of bonds, whether they are I bonds, whether they are TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Bonds, what people have found out is while they sound good and sometimes they turn out very well, there is still substantial interest rate risk. And until the Federal Reserve moves, I think it's very, very difficult to understand where interest rates are moving. So I'd be careful. Go ahead and you can get your feet wet, buy some, but don't buy it all. 50% of what you were intending to buy would be the maximum that I would put in I-bonds.
Okay. Perhaps one other question, a spin-off from the previous caller. I didn't know that you could convert double E's to H-bonds any longer.
Oh, well, I may be wrong about that then. I'm not certain. I thought you still could, but if I could be clearly incorrect about that.
They were
and that's why
the rules on H-bonds, and it was confusing, and I'm not sure.
I thought that was the rule, and I could be mistaken about that.
Well,
in any event, that's the reason to go to the bank, because they can give you all those rules and tell you what those are worth.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, very good. Thank you for the call. We will continue to take questions from people who are listening here. Our guest, by the way, is David Sinnow. He's clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. And 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 are the numbers to call if you'd like to talk with Dave. Ridge Farm is our next caller, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
You hear a lot recently, anyway, about debt consolidation companies.
Sure do.
And are they legit? And they make big promises about being able to lower your interest rates on credit cards and negotiate different things. And because they're nonprofit, they can do that. Is that
Well, there are really two kinds of debt consolidation companies. There are the good old-fashioned mortgage companies that want to consolidate all of your debt if you have some equity in a property. That's the easy way, where you've got credit cards that are a little bit out of hand and you really don't qualify for a conventional mortgage. So there are mortgage companies that specialize in procuring mortgages for people who don't ordinarily qualify at typically higher rates than conventional rates, but far, far lower than credit card rates. So, for example, if I had $40,000 of credit card debt, but I happen to have $60,000 of equity in a house, and I couldn't get a conventional loan, I could go to one of these folks and they can get me what would be an unconventional loan, and maybe my interest rate would be 10 as opposed to 20 on my credit cards. So that's one type of consolidator. The other type of consolidator are these nonprofit firms. They're not refinancing your house, but what they do is they take a look at all of your debt and then they jawbone the credit card companies directly. Now, that's getting harder to do. And the reason that's getting harder to do is because of the new bankruptcy laws. And in the old days, you could say to the credit card company, well, my client owes $5,000 at 24%, and unless you agree to limit that to $2,500, essentially write off $2,500 and consolidate at a lower payment, well, there's a good possibility of my client going bankrupt. And the credit card company, under the old rules, might capitulate. And today, under the new rules, the credit card company may come right back and play hardball and say, well, you know, there's the rules of the game have changed. And if your client tries to declare bankruptcy, that client may not be able to expunge that debt under the new rules and may have to present a plan of repayment anyway. So it's more difficult today because of the change in bankruptcy rules, which are not as consumer-friendly. They're much more credit card-friendly, if you will. But the bottom line is, can you go to one of these debt consolidation companies? Yes, but I would be very leery of paying an upfront fee if they are demanding an upfront fee. I don't want to do that. I wouldn't pay them an upfront fee.
Well, the other question is, how do you find ones that are legit and those that aren't? I mean, they all claim to belong to Better Business Bureau and those sorts of things, but I see that most of them are in Florida where they're not really regulated.
That's correct. That's correct. So it's difficult to do your due diligence. So one of the questions that I would have is I say, I'm very interested in doing business with you. I need three banking references. I want three references. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So refer me to three of the banks or institutions that you do business with and names, serial numbers, so I can visit with them. And if they are leery to give you bank references, then I would be leery about doing business with them.
That sounds legit.
Yeah, it is. It's called due diligence.
And then the other thing, why can't a person negotiate those interest rates themselves?
Well, you probably can. One of the things that you can do yourself is once a year you get the credit card bill and there's suddenly a $50 charge on your credit card because you've just hung on to your card for a year. And often you can call and say, I'm going to drop the card. And often they will get rid of that $50 charge for you. So could you try to negotiate on your own? I suppose. The problem is that you're doing this once in your life. They hear these stories 1,000 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
So they really have the authority, the power, and the know-how.
Well, there must be some kind of benefit for most of these debt consolidators to be nonprofit. Is that right?
Well, they're nonprofit in name only. Believe
right.
me, they're
I
paying large
that.
Salaries to the people, all right? Because they're getting a piece of the savings. That's what's really happening. When you're making that payment back to the debt consolidator, if it's going directly to the debt consolidator each month, a portion of that is going to the debt consolidator. A portion is going back for the repayment of the debt.
And then my other question would be, how does this affect one's credit score? By going through a debt consolidator rather than, is there anything put on your credit that would be negative?
Not certain of that. That's a great question. If you look at a typical credit scoring situation and look at your own credit report, it will typically have late 30, late 60, late 90, charge-offs, etc. But I don't recall ever seeing anything on a credit report that said loan being consolidated with a consolidator. I don't know the answer to that question, so you could ask. One of the interesting issues, though, is if you have a consolidator who suddenly saves you $5,000 or $10,000 of debt, that's forgiveness of debt, and that can be taxable to you. So if you get someone to renegotiate your debt from $10,000 down to $5,000, you've essentially had the credit card company forgive $5,000 of debt.
There are two different terms. There's debt consolidation and debt settlement.
Right.
Debt settlement is what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It should not be done because that will negatively impact your credit score.
Well, and it will also give rise to a taxable event.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem. So this is something that has to be very carefully considered. I'd want to know how long these people are in business.
Well,
for example,
from what I've seen just in little things that I've done on the
mm-hmm.
internet,
mm-hmm.
most of them haven't been around more than 10 years.
Yeah. Well, at least 10 years.
Yeah.
So I'd want to do some special due diligence. Maybe they have a due diligence package that they can send you.
And I think I'd rather do it out of Florida or Maryland where they're not regulated.
Yeah. All right. Well, you seem to know a lot about this. It's an interesting area. I'll do some research on it myself and perhaps report back on it next month.
Okay. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Try to get one more caller here. We have someone listening in Morton Grove on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask David, I had a peculiar situation where I had my Roth IRA mailed to me rather than have it picked up by another bank directly. I did manage to get the funds within 60 days to the other bank and opened the account in within that period of time, and the money flowed back into the other bank. So it seemed like the case was closed, except that apparently there was some interest they didn't forward at the time to the bank, the second bank I'm referring to.
Right.
And I get these statements that you now have $5 or $5.50 or something.
Right.
I was wondering, what kind of trouble am I in tax-wise?
Well, I don't think you're in a lot of trouble with $5.
Yeah.
No one's going to bother you over $5. It was $5,000. It's a problem because really what you have done is you've generated $5 of taxable income. But in my event, what I would try to do is I would direct the current custodian of that money to send that money directly to your new custodian. Did you direct it initially? Was it their mistake initially?
No, actually, I had put the money into the other institution, making up my mind where I would put the money next.
Okay, so you requested that the money be forwarded back to you under the 60-day rule.
Initially, I think that's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think this is not unusual where there is some small amount of money left in an account. You're not the first. And the first step I would try is to direct the first bank to send the money directly to the custodian. You'll pay the postage.
Okay, right.
All right.
Then.
Right.
Okay, I'll take care of that. Thank you.
Very good.
All right, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Well, there, for this time around, we must leave it with our thanks to David Sinnott. He's a clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois.